filled, 20 feet of junk transformed into a flattened, shattered version of nearly an entire missile, a 20-foot-long jigsaw puzzle with few pieces larger than 6 inches. Still, in all those heaps and baskets, engineers never found the infrared homing device the Navy so desperately wanted to study. It was assumed that the devices must have shattered when the missiles careened headlong into their targets at speeds of Mach 1 or Mach 1.5. But the radar altimeter and other crucial parts of that device were found, allowing U.S. engineers to try to build a countermeasure, one that would hopefully send the Soviet cruise missiles plunging harmlessly into the ocean. Meanwhile, word about the cable recordings came back to Bradley from the NSA. His guess had been right. Flowing through that cable was pure military gold. Conversations between the submarine base and high-level Soviet Navy officials, some of them unencrypted or coded in fairly rudimentary ways. The find separated the cable tap from most of the communications intelligence available to the United States. The growing network of spy satellites, planes, listening stations, and subs had watched and listened as the Soviets moved troops, built bases, and sent their fleets swimming through exercises. But even the most advanced eavesdropping system, the prototype of the Rhyolite satellite launched in 1970, could not penetrate a hard-wired phone line. And the few eavesdropping satellites the United States had were focused on Moscow and the Soviets' northern coast. None pointed toward the Pacific bases, the bases that were linked by the cable through Okhotsk. To be sure, Soviet agents provided occasional insights into the Soviet psyche. But for all the drama in dead drops and late-night forays through dark Moscow streets, finding a way to consistently intercept conversations among Soviet military leaders was something that the United States had been trying to do for decades, with only limited success. A set of antennas placed atop the U.S. Embassy in Moscow had captured Brezhnev complaining about his health, and other Politburo members talking about the traffic or their sex lives, but no Soviet leader was going to make a habit of talking about state secrets over something as vulnerable as a car phone. Now the cable tap was providing the first inside look at the Soviet Navy's fears and frustrations, its assessments of its own successes and failures, and its intentions. And the full potential for the Okhotsk cable tap had yet to be measured. These first recordings were only samples, an ear to conversations and reports that took place over a few days on a few of the dozens of lines that ran through the cable under the sea. Bradley saw the next step, and he saw it clearly. He wanted to tap as many of the lines as possible, and he wanted to plant a device that could record for several months, or even a year, a device that would keep working in Okhotsk, even when Halibut was docked at Mare Island. His staff contacted Bell Laboratories, whose engineers were familiar with commercial undersea phone cables, and began designing a much larger tap pod. Just like the smaller recorder Halibut carried on her first trip, the new device worked through induction. But this tap pod was huge. Nearly 20 feet long and more than 3 feet wide, it weighed about 6 tons and utilized a form of nuclear power. It would be able to pick up electronic frequencies from dozens of lines for months at a time and record them on 3-inch tape that ran along a wheel nearly 3 feet in diameter. Halibut could plant the tap 1 year, then go back and retrieve it the next. Leaving behind proof of intrusion was risky, but Bradley's group reasoned that even if the Soviets found the tap, the United States could argue that the induction device was legal. Under U.S. law, the Constitution's prohibition against illegal search and seizure had already been ruled not to apply to currents emanating from buildings, homes, or cables. Navy lawyers wrote up highly classified papers to that effect. These legal contortions might seem disingenuous, but they accompanied almost all covert operations. It was, after all, the United States that kept insisting that other countries operate on high moral ground and within the bounds of international law. When the new tap was finished, it looked like a giant tube that had been squashed some from the top and welded shut at the ends. The device was crammed with miniature electronic circuits and had the capacity to record for weeks at a time. The device was so huge, Halibut's spooks would later call it the Beast. Finally, it was time for Bradley to wade through the formal approval process that he had avoided when the cable was still only a Mississippi River hunch. If Halibut was going to leave evidence of intrusion sitting in Okhotsk, the project would need more than a quiet nod from Haig and Kissinger. Despite Bradley's tensions with the CIA, it had been easy to get the agency officials he worked with to go along. They were so busy building the Glomar Explorer, they didn't mind leaving the cable tap operation to him. So Bradley presented Halibut to the 40 Committee in early 1972, while the American public was being presented with details about Nixon and Kissinger's peace initiatives with Vietnam and their historic trip to China. Given the timing, approval for the TAP mission was anything but certain. For one thing, the Strategic Arms Limitation Talks, SALT, were at a make-or-break stage. For another, Kissinger and Zumwalt, the CNO, were engaged in an open feud. Kissinger had made a glaring mistake during arms negotiations that threatened to leave the Soviets with a dangerous lead in submarine-based ballistic missiles. In secret talks away from his military advisors, he had agreed, offhandedly, not to ask for limits on the Soviets' massive effort to build the Deltas, a new class of submarines that would far surpass the Yankees and carry ballistic missiles with ranges of 4,000 miles. Zumwalt was furious, convinced that Kissinger and Nixon had given away the barn in their zeal to get SALT completed before the year's elections. Zumwalt, who passed off words of caution from State Department officials, calling them bedwetters, was trying to force Kissinger to pay for his negotiating mistake by pressuring him to approve an even more powerful new class of U.S. missile subs, the Tridents. It was a battle he would win. Zumwalt did have another edge. Submarine spying had received a boost in Kissinger's and Nixon's eyes in mid-1972, when U.S. surveillance subs detected one of the rare overt Soviet moves to intervene in the Vietnam War. Shortly after Nixon announced the mining of Haiphong Harbor, the Soviet Navy sent three Echo 2 subs toward Vietnam. After they were detected by U.S. subs, Washington sent a message to Moscow, essentially saying, "Send them back home, or their history." The subs left. Now that the CNO had thrown his considerable weight behind Halibut and her return to Okhotsk, and damn the risk, it seemed that the cable tap could easily become a pawn in the battle between the White House and the Navy. Bradley did what he could to play down the risks, making his presentation without reference to a what-if-Halibut-were-caught scenario. Beyond that, much of what he offered the 40 Committee was pure drama. The captain pulled out a map of Okhotsk. He pointed to where the signs were found on the beach and drew a path over the sea to indicate the cable. Then he boldly stated what had once been only a guess, that this was a cable that carried crucial information about the operations and development of Soviet ballistic missile submarines. His discussion of the dangers was limited to the harrowing undersea walks facing Halibut's divers. What Bradley didn't tell the committee was just how he knew there was a cable in the first place. He left out the fact that Halibut, on Haig's nod, had already visited the wire. He only assured the committee that the Navy was certainly not going to draft the operations orders until it was convinced that it could engineer a cable tap. By the time he was finished, Bradley had won over the room. If the arms control negotiations or political machinations gave these officials pause, they didn't show it. The cable tap mission was approved, and Halibut left for her second trip to Okhotsk on August 4, 1972. 2 months after the break-in at Democratic Party headquarters at the Watergate complex, Halibut was on her way to perform the ultimate wiretapping exercise for an administration that was about to be crushed under its own tapes and covert operations. This time, McNish decided to brief his men about their true mission and the risks they would encounter. He called them into the crew's mess, one-third of the men at a time. Characteristically solemn, his grin a tight wire across his face, he stood against the bulkhead and told them where they were going, told them about the cable, told them about the tap. Then McNish told his men something else. He told them about black boxes strategically placed at bow, stern, and midship. They were filled with explosives, and they were wired for self-destruct. The boxes were not carried by regular attack subs, but on Halibut, every torpedo man's mate had been trained to crimp the explosive caps attached to fuses to ready the demolition boxes for detonation. Should Halibut become trapped in Okhotsk, McNish told his men, she would not be boarded, and her crew would not be taken alive. This briefing was presumably at odds with general Navy security rules. Most of the crew had no need to know where they were going or why. But McNish was asking his crew to go out for 6 months and take a risk unmatched in peacetime. Need or not, his men had a right to know. On the way to the place her men were now calling Oshkosh, Halibut was stranded, her clutch blew, sending the shaft to her screws spinning uncontrollably. A Halibut newcomer devised a jury rig involving a series of braces and a hydraulic jack attached to the motor. The fix held. The men were by now affectionately referring to their usually ailing, most of the time moving, underwater nuclear-powered habitat as the Bat Boat. The moniker stuck when somebody noticed that the huge bump created by the Bat Cave hangar made the sub look like a giant rendering of Bruce Wayne's comic book supercar. Back in Okhotsk, Halibut found the cable easily. McNish gave the order, and the two huge anchors descended from bow and stern. The divers climbed out of the DSRV lockout. In a matter of hours, spooks were listening to voices coming from the cable. "Get in here, you have to hear this," one of the spooks called to some of the chiefs. As he listened, one chief's eyes opened wide. He understood Niet Russian, but that didn't seem to matter. "Jesus, this is great," the chief said, shaking his head. "Jesus!" Then he began to laugh, a deep-throated, gut-shaking laugh, built at once of pure bravado and the realization that they could all be caught listening to a conversation they were never meant to hear. With an adolescent conspirator's sense of occasion, the chief took off his headphones and slipped them to the next man in line. A fortunate few were these chiefs, these men on the inside track, who had the good luck to be pals with the spooks. One after another, they took their turns meeting the enemy they had tracked, pointed weapons at, harangued, and forsaken their families for. They were taking part in history. They were meeting the Soviets ear to ear, with one side deaf to the transaction. None of this, of course, concerned the two Soviets yammering happily away on the telephone in unscrambled, uncoded Russian. They had no idea that 3,850 tons of steel and more than 120 men had conspired together to listen in to their conversation, or that soon their words would be weighted with layers of classification and given points for intelligence value in Washington. A celebration was in order, and the divers provided one. Plucking a giant spider crab from the seashore, they sent it into halibut through the DSRV lockout. One of the chiefs grabbed hold of a spindly leg, then a huge body. Someone else found a platter, a big one, the biggest one on the boat. It wasn't big enough. With legs dangling, its brownish-gray body hanging off the steel plate, the crab moved slowly as it was paraded through the engine room toward a massive pot of boiling water, on its way to becoming the only casualty of the mission. McNish kept halibut hovering over the line for at least a week. Then halibut made her way out of Okhotsk, leaving the tap planted and the internal recorders running. The submarine would come back to pick the recordings up in about a month. For now, the men were going to Guam. They would stay there long enough to let the tapes fill some more, and long enough to patch whatever had broken on their bat boat. It was a routine port stop, at least until their final night. The officers, the enlisted men, the chiefs, most everybody who was not on watch, went out drinking. Then talk among the chiefs in the non-commissioned officers' club turned to the cable tap. No one remembers who was the first to blurt out what was probably on most everyone's mind, but somebody, whether moved by fear or made courageous by beer, cracked the veneer and asked the question. Had they crossed a crucial line? This wasn't like going up against another sub or a ship and watching from afar. This was eavesdropping. What the hell were they doing crawling into the Soviet Union's backyard and tapping a military cable in peacetime? Why were they risking their lives for a mission they were all sure the United States would never acknowledge? Why were they riding a boat with a captain who had made clear that his hand was on the self-destruct button? Why were they riding a boat that could disappear without a word to their families of how or why? Once it began, there was no stopping it. Fear, anger, concern poured across the table. This had been building from the first moment the spooks pulled the chiefs into the radio shack and handed them the headphones. Listening to those words they didn't understand, coming from a tap they weren't supposed to have planted, didn't seem funny anymore. What once struck them as exciting and daring now seemed just plain illegal and dangerous. Few of the men suffered qualms of morality or politics. As far as they were concerned, détente and diplomacy were public shows put on by both sides to hide true intentions. Still, what they were doing, the men told themselves, could be construed as an act of war. Worse, what they were doing could start the war they feared most. For perhaps the first time since they had joined the submarine service and faced the power of the oceans and the threat of Soviet depth charges and torpedoes, some of these men were suddenly, deeply certain that what they were doing could kill them. Then one man said that they ought to tell the old man to stuff it, that they ought to tell him they didn't want to go back. Then others said the same thing in different ways. More beers were ordered and downed. Then together they made their way to the dock. Together they stood in front of their submarine. Then, one by one, they climbed down the hatch, realizing that they weren't going to go tell McNish to stuff it after all. They were going to their bunks or to their posts, and they were going back out to the Sea of Okhotsk. Soon everyone was on board, except Auxiliaryman's chief, John White. He stood on the pier and announced he was not going down the hatch. As far as he was concerned, the submarine service was a volunteer service, and he was devolunteering. Nobody expected this. White had served more than 19 years. He was the kind of man who always worked harder than his crew, the kind who rewarded their hard work by sending them out on the town on his tab. Maybe it was the beer talking. Only, White didn't seem drunk enough to throw away his career when he was only 1 year away from a full pension. Still, something had made White decide to do just that, something that he refused to talk about, that day on the pier, or since. In the end, he would say only that he wasn't reacting to the mission or to the self-destruct charges on board, that it was all more personal than that. Whatever his reason, Halibut pulled from port without him. White was flown back from Guam to California, where he was given an honorable discharge with a normal 20-year pension. For the rest of the trip, it was White the chiefs talked about. Soon they were back in the spook shack, listening to the Soviets. This time they even understood a little of what they heard, as one Soviet sailor used the telephone line to practice wooing his girlfriend in English. The chiefs listened and laughed, but the joy of conspiracy had left the boat with John White. This was to be the final leg of their trip. Their orders were to collect every last bit of information they could, then leave behind the tap to silently record the Soviets through the months that would pass before Halibut could again make the long trip back to Okhotsk. They hovered over the cable for a week, maybe more, long enough for even White's dramatic exit to become blurred into the general monotony of watch, meals, poker, sleep. Watch, meals, poker, sleep. By now, the sub had been out for nearly 5 months, and most of the men just wanted to start their crawl home. Then, abruptly, their routine was broken. A storm above began boiling beneath the surface. The divers were trapped outside, unable to climb back into the DSRV chamber, as Halibut strained against her anchors one moment, then slammed into the sea floor the next. All the men could do was try to keep a safe distance and watch. There was no way the officers and crew manning the diving planes could keep Halibut level. The gauge measuring anchor tension moved from 10,000 pounds to 50,000 pounds, to zero, to 20,000 pounds, to 50,000 pounds, and back to zero again. An hour passed, then another. Then there was a loud crunch. Both steel anchors snapped at once, broke so easily that they could have been rubber bands. Outside, the divers watched as Halibut began to drift upward. The men were still linked to the submarine through their air hoses. They knew that they would die if Halibut pulled them up before they could decompress. If they cut themselves loose, they would suffocate. Inside, the officer of the deck was well aware of the danger when he shouted a desperate order. "Flood it!" He said it a second time. Valves were rolled wide open, and Halibut began to take in tons of water, filling her ballast tanks in a matter of seconds. Belly first, she crashed into the sand. The divers scrambled into the DSRV chamber. The horrendous ride was over, but there was no guarantee the submarine would ever be able to break free of the muddy sand. Rocks scraped against and past the hull, an ongoing crunch, until the men on board were certain the barrage would wreck their boat, that they would never leave Okhotsk. "Christ, we're here forever," one mechanic said through gritted teeth. "Hell, we weren't supposed to be here in the first place," another man muttered. Halibut sat, one day leading into another. The storm passed, but McNish wouldn't try to raise the boat until he had milked the cable for everything he could record. He and his crew were going to go home with their tapes full, if they went home at all. Finally, McNish gave the word. It was time to leave. It was time to see if McNish's desperation order to throw Halibut belly down into the sand had saved the mission, or killed them all. Halibut couldn't just power up and drive out. Submarines were designed to be free-floating, to draw in water for crucial cooling systems from seawater intake valves that were now pressed down by a submarine's weight in sand. Tensely, At McNish's word, the men blew a bit of ballast. It wasn't enough. Halibut was mired, and would need a full emergency blow to get out. But in water just 400 feet deep, she might end up blowing herself to the surface and to exposure. The crew decided to try to engineer an emergency blow to free their sub, and almost instantly after, take on enough water again to remain submerged. Sort of like trying to exhale and inhale water nearly at the same time, to leave their sub bobbing mid-depth. The men also knew they had to get it right the first time. Halibut had enough compressed air to attempt the move only once. They would be freed, or they would be stuck, and there would be no argument either way. Halibut was freed. She had an entirely uneventful trip across the Pacific. The response to her return, however, was anything but uneventful. Bradley got the word from the NSA almost immediately. The tap had recorded as many as 20 lines at once. The NSA had been able to separate all of them electronically. Halibut had hit the mother lode. There were conversations between Soviet field commanders covering operational tactics and plans and maintenance problems, including defects that could cause missile submarines, like the Yankees, which were now beginning to patrol in the Pacific, to make noises that might help U.S. submarines in their efforts to track the enemy. Logistical business was conducted through the line. Reports that ships couldn't get underway for lack of spare parts. There was also other high-level reporting of command and control, decisions made about when and if patrols would get underway, and which submarines would be sent to lurk off of U.S. shores. There were discussions of personnel problems, training problems, requests for more men, complaints when those men failed to arrive at Petropavlovsk. Then there were the intangibles, the dreaded political officers on Soviet submarines, revealing their own private views about party leaders. The Soviet command also allowed young submariners to use the lines, patching their calls through to local stations where the men could wish Mama a happy birthday, or ask their sweetheart to wait. All this put a human face on the massive enemy across the ocean. This second effort to tap the cable confirmed one disappointment. There seemed to be little, if any, information about missile tests running through the line. Bradley had had great hopes that there would be information about the success of splashdowns of land- and sea-based intercontinental ballistic missiles, but overall, the tap was an intelligence gold mine. Nevertheless, there would have to be a few changes. Bell Laboratories was asked to find a way to program the next tap pod so that it could hone in on what were deemed the most crucial lines, and so the recorders could turn on and shut off to conserve tape. The idea was to program the tap for prime time, although at this stage no one at the NSA was really sure what constituted prime time, any more than they knew for certain which lines were best. Bradley's office also had to let Rickover in on the program, at least in a limited way, despite his rancor toward the boat and her previous commander. Bradley needed Rickover's permission to make an important structural change. The captain didn't want to risk another incident like the one that had almost killed Halibut's divers. She was going to get a pair of sleigh-like feet. From now on, she would not anchor over the tapsite. She'd be equipped to sit on the bottom when she went back to Okhotsk again in 1974 and 1975. The details of Halibut's mechanics didn't interest the greater intelligence community, but the recordings did. The Navy had pulled the ultimate in one-upmanship. No human agent or standard spy boat could have collected the wealth of information that Halibut brought home. The NSA bestowed a code name on what was now an ongoing operation, Ivy Bells. Bradley would plan more of these missions, and other submarines would be refitted to follow Halibut's path to Okhotsk. But Bradley would never know firsthand what his efforts had wrought. The NSA would give Naval Intelligence detailed summaries of the take, but unlike Halibut's chiefs, he would never hear a single minute of the tapes. The NSA decided that Bradley, who had imagined the cable, envisioned the signs pointing it out, and labored to get funding and clearances for the mission, hadn't earned this bit of currency. Bradley, it was deemed, simply had no need to listen. No need to know. Chapter 9. The $500 Million Sandcastle. It was October 22, 1973, and journalist Seymour M. Hersh was taking notes in a reporter's staccato, partial sentences, partial secrets that he ingested along with dinner, as he sat in a suburban restaurant with a source whose name he was bound by ethics and bargain never to reveal. At the moment, anyone would have expected this 36-year-old Pulitzer Prize winner to have been entirely embroiled in Watergate. He was, after all, the top investigative reporter for the New York Times, albeit one who was rumpled and stubborn and given to bursts of profanity, and he was running a frustrated second to Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein of the Washington Post in the race to uncover the story that would make legends of these unknown scruffy reporters and felons of their more polished and powerful targets. Watergate scoops, however, were not what Hersh had come to this dinner for, and the man he was dining with did not belong to the group that soon would be branded All the President's Men. This man ran in different company, in the company of spies, perhaps in the company, as the CIA was known. He had only recently stepped down from his post as a high-ranking national security official. He was, as Hersh put it, somebody who sat at the catbird's seat for a long time. More than that, Hersh would forever refuse to reveal. Indeed, he was taking considerable trouble to meet this man in secret, slipping out of the Washington, D.C. bureau of the Times to catch up with him in another city. Hersh was making this trip because there was a story he wanted almost as much as the epic of a collapsing presidency. He had been getting tips for years about costly wastes and excessive dangers in U.S. intelligence operations, including some of the Navy's most secret submarine spy missions. Now he wanted to shine a light on this pitch-black world that had always been left to operate under a peculiar type of political immunity that could only be imparted by the words top secret and highly classified. These phrases had once been read by journalists and lawmakers as signals to back off and stop asking questions. But these days, the Watergate saga was emboldening the press and Congress, encouraging them to be more skeptical, and Hersh was at the forefront of a drive to hold the intelligence community accountable for what it had been doing behind the veil. Much of what he had been hearing dealt with cost overruns on spy satellites and the risks being taken in undersea spy programs. He also had learned about the Holy Stone surveillance submarines that were darting into Soviet waters. And just recently, Hersh had started picking up scattered rumors about a CIA operation designed to steal something that the Soviets had lost or discarded at the bottom of an ocean. Three times he had been told that the agency was constructing an enormous barge that could reach down through miles of raging currents, crushing pressures, and unending darkness. He knew the plan only by its code name, Project Jennifer. The references were tantalizing, but oblique. None of his sources had been able or willing to tell Hersh just what the CIA was after. One government official had hinted that the agency was seeking pieces of spent ballistic missiles that had been fired in tests from the Tyuratom Test Center deep inside the Soviet Union into the Pacific. But Hersh didn't trust the information. He feared that the official was either offering up a guess or dangling deliberate misinformation. Now, however, Hersh was meeting with a man he knew he could trust. Appetizers were put on the table as new leads passed across. But it wasn't until the meal was ending that Hirsch tossed out two words. As if offering up dessert, he repeated the code name that he had been unable to decipher. Project Jennifer. Hirsch waited. For a heartbeat, maybe 10, trying to look nonchalant. Then all at once he began scribbling, catching facts along with concern and skepticism as they poured from the man sitting across the dinner table. Russian sub went down in Atlantic, Hirsch wrote. Jennifer is designed to find it. We know where it is. Next came the words that revealed what may have been this source's reason for telling Hirsch anything at all. Don't you think the Russians know why there's a U.S. trawler with exotic gear out there in the middle of the ocean? Copying it all down, Hirsch knew he now held the heart of what could be one of the most exotic undertakings of the Cold War, an operation known to perhaps only a few dozen people in the government. The source didn't say how the CIA had found the submarine, and Hirsch didn't realize until much later that his companion had placed the Soviet boat in the wrong ocean. But he had outlined what seemed to Hirsch to be the perfect allegory, the perfect way to question what was wrong with U.S. intelligence. Here was a tale of an agency spinning a seemingly impossible dream that might antagonize the Soviets just as détente was starting to ease the worst of the Cold War tensions. In fact, that very day the United States and the Soviet Union had jointly issued a call for a ceasefire in the Middle East war that had started on Yom Kippur. Hirsch went back to his other sources, pushing and pleading. But his efforts still hadn't netted much information. Then, 4 months after the clandestine dinner, on a Saturday evening in January 1974, Hirsch got a break. He was at a Washington dinner party, one of those affairs where officials hobnob with journalists, both thinly disguising questions and evasions as small talk. This night, Hirsch was parrying with a newly retired CIA officer when his tendency toward swagger overwhelmed caution. Smiling wryly, casting his voice with just the right amount of scorn, Hirsch asked with the certainty of an insider why anyone would care about retrieving some old submarine from the bottom of the ocean. He made sure that he worked the name Jennifer into the sentence. Later he would admit that he was probably showing off. The former officer seemed not to react, offering not the slightest sign of annoyance, concern, or recognition. But Hirsch had hit a nerve. He must have, because as soon as the party was over, the officer was on the telephone with William E. Colby, who had been director of the CIA for only 5 months. The news that Hirsch had gotten hold of Project Jennifer hit the CIA with megaton force. Colby knew that Hirsch had won his Pulitzer for breaking the story of the My Lai massacre in Vietnam, and the director considered him a good ferreter-outer. Colby also knew that after 6 years of planning and preparation, his secret was about to get out. Contrary to what Hirsch's source had said, the huge ship that had been commissioned for the project was not yet out to sea. But it had been completed, built by Howard Hughes's Summa Corporation. Christened the Glomar Explorer, she was the length of 3 football fields, with decks crammed with computer-operated equipment, pulleys and cranes, all designed to send a giant clawed arm diving through nearly 17,000 feet of ocean, down to the bottom, where it was supposed to grab hold of the lost Soviet submarine and pull her to the surface. Only a few final tests remained before Glomar would be ready to set out on Project Jennifer. 5 more months, and the CIA would be able to try its salvage attempt. The idea had already survived the opposition of the men most responsible for finding the Gulf in the first place, Captain James Bradley, who would be retiring in a month, and John Craven, who was already retired. Bradley and Craven still believed that the late 1950s-era Soviet boat was of little intelligence value, and certainly not worth the cost and dubious chance of success involved in trying to pull her out of the ocean. Instead, they had proposed a far simpler and less dangerous plan to recover the Gulf's most valuable treasures. Develop unmanned submersibles equipped to blow holes in the Gulf's hull and grab the missile warheads, communications gear, and decoding machines, just about the only things of any real value on the sub. The wisdom behind their caution seemed even clearer now. The Soviets barely relied on the Gulfs anymore. They were nearly finished building a fleet of 34 Yankees, and they were about to introduce the even more lethal Delta missile subs. The first Deltas, already on sea trials, were slated to head out on patrol in 1974, and 2 to 3 dozen more were planned. The Deltas carried missiles that could travel 4,200 nautical miles, or nearly 6 times as far as the antiquated ones sitting in the Gulf's wreckage. Bradley and other naval intelligence officials also felt that the sub force was finally starting to get a handle on tracking Soviet subs at sea, and they saw no need for any desperate moves. 2 or 3 Yankees were always in the Atlantic now, and SOSUS had been calibrated well enough to pick them up as they moved in round-robin fashion through patrol zones known as the Yankee Boxes, southeast of Bermuda and west of the Azores. Indeed, more SOSUS stations were being set up, and U.S. warships were now towing portable sonar arrays to cover areas where SOSUS was deaf. Naval intelligence also had created operational intelligence centers on both coasts and in Europe and Japan, which were correlating all the data coming in on Soviet sub-movements and disseminating daily updates. During the Arab-Israeli Yom Kippur War, the United States had managed to keep close tabs on 26 Soviet missile and attack subs in the Mediterranean, one U.S. attack sub handing off responsibility to another as they kept constant track of individual Soviet subs in the crowd. But the CIA's elaborate plan to completely recover the Gulf still appealed to Nixon and Kissinger, who was now Secretary of State. They were so firmly behind the decision to grab the entire sub that final approvals were coming in right on schedule. Several top congressional leaders also had been briefed. It was somewhat remarkable that the secret ever had survived the years it had taken to build the massive Glomar Explorer. Now the ship was well hidden, in plain sight, shrouded by a cover story the CIA considered perfect. The country's most famous and wealthy eccentric was building Glomar to corner the market on manganese nodules, golf ball-sized clumps of minerals that sat on the ocean floor. The venture, as promoted, was expensive, and there were far simpler ways to obtain manganese, but nobody questioned that Hughes would take huge risks to control a new market, nor did anyone seem surprised about the secrecy surrounding the project. Hughes was a well-known paranoid, and secrecy had marked his huge empires in aviation, oil drilling, and hotels. But Hirsch had never heard the cover story, had leapfrogged it altogether with one crucial interview. Colby, who was known for a near-legendary calm under pressure, was becoming very nervous. A story in the papers could kill the entire mission before the Glomar Explorer ever embarked. CIA lawyers had, of course, crafted legal briefs outlining why the United States had every right in the world to try to salvage Soviet property in the middle of the ocean. But those briefs, like those crafted to adorn nearly every covert mission, were useful only for public deniability. With or without supporting legal arguments, Colby knew that international law made clear that sunken warships always belonged to the country that had sailed them. Colby couldn't muzzle Hirsch, not legally, but he could cajole, and that's just what he planned to do when he went to visit Hirsch at the Times' Washington bureau. Hirsch and Colby were a generation and a war apart, and at this time, that was a gap galaxies wide. The 54-year-old Colby had walked into the intelligence services during World War II, an era when journalists and novelists vied to craft the most romantic portraits of the nation's spies, of their daring and panache. Hirsch, on the other hand, had been practically thrown out of the Pentagon as an Associated Press reporter during the Vietnam War for continuously and hostily questioning the military's line. Now Colby stood before Hirsch, hoping to make a bargain. He had come to believe that the only way to maintain public support for intelligence efforts was by, as he would say, bringing intelligence out of the shadows. For his part, Hirsch thought Colby essentially honest. He also believed that was probably a bad thing for a CIA director who had to deal with more hard-line agency veterans. And so the two men sat down to talk. The director wanted Hirsch to hold his story, to stop digging, to not even talk about Project Jennifer. Hirsch listened to Colby, knowing full well that he was far from ready to go to press. Nonetheless, there was an opportunity here. So Hirsch said that he expected Watergate to keep him too occupied to go after Project Jennifer, at least for the next several months. After a bit of bluffing that suggested he knew more about Project Jennifer than he did, Hirsch redirected the conversation. Hirsch wanted to know about CIA ties to Watergate. Colby happily answered Hirsch's questions, and he left the Times convinced that he had bought at least 2 or 3 months of quiet. Indeed, Hirsch was still absorbed in the president's scandal when Glomar left port 5 months later, and the reporter was still writing about Watergate when she hovered over the Soviet submarine that July in a spot in the Pacific about 1,700 miles northwest of Hawaii. It seemed obvious to Colby that his secret was holding. Over the next weeks, he received reports that the only Soviet ships that passed anywhere near Glomar were commercial vessels. Still, many of Glomar's crew members feared the Soviets would figure out what was going on. Most of Glomar's men were roughnecks, recruited from U.S. oil fields, chosen because they could handle Glomar's massive crane and other equipment. None of the men wanted an encounter with the Soviets. The men wanted to get the job done and go home. New photographs taken by cameras dangled by Glomar showed that the Gulf was still in much the same condition as when Halibut had found her 6 years earlier. The Soviet sub was listing toward starboard. Photos taken through missing and damaged hatches made it clear that there was still one intact nuclear missile. The other two had been damaged when the submarine went down. Except for a hole blown nearly 10 feet wide just behind the conning tower, probably from the explosion that had sunk her, the Gulf appeared to be in one piece. Still, there was a good possibility she was fragile. The Navy had estimated that the Gulf had slammed to the ocean bottom at more than 100 knots. That kind of impact could easily have left her broken beneath the steel outer plating. That was one of the key reasons Bradley and Craven had pushed for a more limited recovery effort. But at that moment, the biggest hurdle was reaching the submarine in the first place. It was a task that one man who recruited Glomar's crew compared to lifting a 25-foot-long steel tube off the ground with a cable lowered from the top of the 110-story World Trade Center on a pitch-black night, haunted by swirling winds. Computers in the Glomar's control room began flashing information as the giant claw was slowly lowered into the depths. The claw and its steel arm had been nicknamed Clementine, after the classic miner's lament. Indeed, at least the Soviets believed their boat to be lost and gone forever. The arm resembled a huge octopus that would ultimately dangle on a miles-long tether. It had 8 grasping claws, 3 of which supported a huge steel net. The tether itself was being built a piece at a time by Glomar's men, who linked sections of pipe, each 60 feet long, one by one, giant tinker toys, creating an ever-lengthening leash dangling ever lower into the ocean. Later, when it was time to try to raise the submarine, crewmen would hoist the claw and the sub by pulling the pieces of pipe from the ocean, dismantling the tether one section at a time. It took days to lower Clementine to the bottom, days before the grasping claws were hovering directly over the submarine. Then, when the tether was 3 miles long, Glomar's men and computers labored to compensate for the swirling current so that they could drape the steel net held by 3 of the claws over the Gulf's conning tower. Finally, when cameras showed one of the grasping claws in contact with the sub, the men tried to maneuver the arm closer so the remaining claws could reach around and grab. But the men miscalculated, sending Clementine crashing into the seabed. They backed the arm partway up, studying the images sent back to the ship. In the murky, partially lit ocean, the arm looked amazingly intact, as though it could still grab. They decided to send Clementine back for another try. Again they aimed, and again they sent the steel net falling over the conning tower. This time all 5 claws were in position. It seemed as though Glomar was going to be able to reel in its catch after all. 6 feet a minute. That was how fast the Gulf was pulled toward the surface. 5,000 tons of waterlogged steel. Glomar began to sink deeper into the water against the pull, and then began bucking under the strain. Conversation among the crew shifted from talk of capture to capsizing. 9 hours passed, and the Gulf was 3,000 feet off the seabed. More time, and the submarine was 5,000 feet off the ocean floor, 2 miles away from the surface. Another minute promised to bring another 6 feet of progress. Instead, it brought the wrenching realization that the Gulf would never rise any higher. With one jerk, 3 of the grasping claws cracked and fell away. They had probably been damaged by the crash into the ocean floor so many hours ago. Now there were only 2 claws, and the net left holding the forward section of the Gulf. The rest of the submarine was dangling mid-ocean, and within moments proved itself just as fragile as Bradley and Craven had predicted 6 years earlier. The steel of the Gulf began to tear at its seams, until the bulk of the sub ripped free from the small section still in Clementine's grasp and fell back into the depths. Back to the ocean floor went the intact nuclear missile, the code books, the decoding machines, the burst transmitters. Everything the CIA most wanted to reclaim. There were no celebrations as the Glomar headed home, no sense of victory that she carried back about 10% of a Soviet submarine. Most of this portion was nearly useless from an intelligence standpoint. Glomar was still out to sea on August 8th when a report came over the radio. Richard Nixon had resigned in disgrace. Air Force One flew Nixon back to San Clemente, California for the last time, and much of the crew of this, what was perhaps the last top-secret mission he had sanctioned, blamed his demise on the damned media. Back in Washington, the political storm that had so engulfed Hirsch abated with Nixon's departure. Hirsch had heard nothing of Glomar's attempt, nor of its failure. Nor was he alerted when the CIA's underwater experts began plotting a second try for the sunken Gulf. But with Nixon out of the White House, Hirsch was back on the intelligence beat. That December, he published a huge exposé on the front page of the Times, charging that the CIA had conducted a massive illegal domestic intelligence operation, compiling dossiers on 10,000 or more American citizens. CIA operatives, the story said, had been shadowing war protesters and infiltrating anti-war organizations. The CIA would never fully recover from the charges. Hirsch's story set off a wave of public and congressional condemnation and scrutiny. In an effort to keep the inevitable investigations in friendly hands, The new president, Gerald Ford, created a Blue Ribbon Commission to examine Hirsch's charges. This time, however, younger members of Congress pushed past the old guard who had always shielded the CIA and insisted that the House and the Senate conduct investigations of their own. Colby and Hirsch were still enmeshed with the fallout from the domestic spying story when Project Jennifer popped back to the surface. It happened on Friday afternoon, February 7, 1975. The early edition of the next day's Los Angeles Times hit the streets, screaming news of the recovery attempt in a banner headline splayed across page one. U.S. reported after Russian submarine. Sunken ship deal by CIA, Hughes told. After holding on to the story for nearly a year, Hirsch had been scooped. The Los Angeles Times story had mistakes. It said the sunken sub was in the Atlantic and gave only limited details. Still, as far as Hirsch was concerned, the story was out, and he saw no reason not to step in and finally publish a full account. Colby was just as determined to stop him. For Colby, the stakes were still huge. Unknown to Hirsch, Project Jennifer was far from over. The CIA was moving ahead with plans for a second recovery attempt. After the first awful failure, CIA technical experts had convinced Colby that the Glomar Explorer could still reach down and steal crucial pieces of the Gulf. The huge ship was already being refitted and repaired, and the second try was scheduled for that summer. To Colby, it seemed as if he were right back where he had started with Hirsch a year earlier. Colby believed that if the matter died quickly, the Soviets might miss the Los Angeles Times story altogether. But if the article began to get attention, or if Hirsch stepped in now with a better rendition of the facts, perhaps with the actual location of the Gulf, Colby would have to halt the operation and the agency would have to shoulder another fiasco, one with a huge price tag. The CIA immediately sent two agents to see the editor of the Los Angeles Times. Their message was simple. Jennifer was not over, and publicity could make it impossible for the CIA to bring home the big catch. Neither agent said that there had already been one dismal failure, nor did they specifically say that plans were afoot for a second attempt. But the editor wasn't asking too many questions. He just agreed to bury the Glomar story on page 18 in the paper's final editions, and promised not to run any follow-ups, at least not for the time being. Colby then called the New York Times publisher and asked him to have Hirsch cool it down a little on Jennifer. He also returned another call from Hirsch telling him, "You've been first class about this for a long time." But the flattery wasn't going to stop Hirsch from digging into the story now, and other reporters were jumping on it as well. So Colby crafted a desperate plan, one that was unprecedented in the annals of agency history. He decided to tell dozens of editors and publishers, broadcasters and producers, about Project Jennifer, to give them some details. But his offering carried a price. The editors, in turn, were being asked to hold the story back. Colby made one last concession. If it looked as though anyone was going to break the embargo, he would call all the others and give them the go-ahead to publish. He knew full well that keeping Jennifer out of the papers would be about as easy as forcing a lid on a boiling pot. He began describing himself as the center of the weirdest conspiracy in town. That's not to say Colby trusted his co-conspirators. The CIA began to monitor some of the reporters who were working on the story. Agents secretly recorded their conversations with journalists, investigated their backgrounds, and rated their performances. There were dozens of secret files. One unidentified West Coast reporter, codenamed E-14, was deemed a journalistic prostitute and a heavy drinker. But above all others, Colby and crew were watching Hirsch. They tracked who he talked to on a trip to the West Coast, helped by the fact that many of the people he tried to interview reported straight back to Colby. Among the people Hirsch contacted was John Craven, who was now teaching at the University of Hawaii. Although Craven's dreams of building a fleet of small deep submergence search vehicles had been swamped by the enormous cost of the Glomar Explorer, he wasn't about to cough up the secret.
"Project what?" Craven answered when Hirsch told him what he was chasing. Still, Craven agreed to meet Hirsch a week later at the Ornate Cosmos Club in Washington, D.C. The Undersecretary of the Navy urged Craven to try to find out who Hirsch's sources were, but by the time they got together, fencing and blustering over cocktails, neither man gave up much. It was clear that Hirsch had the story in hand, whether Craven gave him any help or not. Finally, on March 18th, syndicated investigative columnist Jack Anderson declared an end to the intrigue and prepared to air the story during his show on the Mutual Radio Network. Colby rushed in, but Anderson refused to reconsider. "I don't think the government has a right to cover up a boondoggle," he said later. "I have withheld other stories at the behest of the CIA, but this was simply a cover-up of a $350 million failure. $350 million literally went down into the ocean." Government officials later put the cost at more than $500 million. The story was out, and Hirsch finally got to publish his much fuller account of Project Jennifer in the next day's New York Times. It ran with a five-column, three-line headline: CIA salvage ship brought up part of Soviet sub lost in 1968, failed to raise atom missiles. The banner treatment of the word failed was enough to make Colby cringe, and the story's lead probably didn't make him feel any better. The Central Intelligence Agency financed the construction of a multi-million-dollar deep-sea salvage vessel and used it in an unsuccessful effort last summer to recover hydrogen warhead missiles and codes from a sunken Soviet submarine in the Pacific Ocean, according to high government officials. Hirsch went on to note that the CIA recovered only an insignificant forward chunk of the Gulf, and he summed up the assessment of unnamed critics, saying that the possibility of retrieving outmoded code books and outmoded missiles did not justify either the high cost of the operation or its potential for jeopardizing the United States-Soviet détente. Overall, the story was a picture of waste, not heroics, and one that some naval officers quietly applauded. The CIA had, after all, been trying to swim in their waters, had stolen their prized find, and had sunk hundreds of millions of dollars in the process. Project Jennifer was a bust, and in the Navy's eyes, it was also a downright foolish mission to begin with. Hirsch mistakenly wrote that as many as 70 bodies had been recovered in the wreckage, when only 6 were recovered. But he did also echo one of the points that Colby had been most intent on making, that the CIA had held a burial service for the Soviet dead and videotaped it in case the Soviet Union ever found out about the recovery attempt and demanded information. Colby himself had stopped talking altogether, rationalizing his belated silence as the only way to prevent the Soviets from being forced into a public reaction. He made that point at a visit to the White House. Toting a copy of Nikita Khrushchev's memoirs, he showed President Ford where Khrushchev wrote that he had been forced to feign public outrage and cancel a summit meeting in 1960, when Eisenhower openly admitted that the U-2s flying over the Soviet Union were spy planes, and not simply weather planes blown off course. Not wanting to repeat Eisenhower's error, the Ford administration met all further queries about Glomar with a strict no comment. That was exactly what the Soviets wanted. They began sending frantic back-channel messages through any contacts they had, begging for U.S. silence, anything to keep the story from Soviet citizens who were still in the dark.
The Soviets had good reason to want the story quashed. Losing a sub and failing to find it was bad enough. It was even worse that the Americans had found it and tried to wrench it from the ocean, and worse still that the best Soviet intelligence officers had read about that in American newspapers. But making the whole matter even more humiliating was the fact that the Soviets had been forewarned about Project Jennifer and ignored the warning. When Glomar went out on sea trials in early 1974, Anatoly Shteryov, a young Soviet officer, had tried to warn his boss, Admiral N. Smirnov, commander and chief of the Pacific Fleet. As far as Shteryov could tell, the lost Soviet submarine was the only item of value in the region where Glomar Explorer was sighted. By then, the Soviets had mapped out a general area where they believed their sub was lost. Despite Kolbe's intelligence that no hostile vessels had come near Glomar, Smirnov had responded instantly. He sent a high-speed surveillance ship to the area. It got there months too soon, months before the actual recovery attempt. The surveillance crew reported back to Moscow only that they saw a U.S. ship of incomprehensible design the size of a soccer field with trusses resembling oil derricks, keeping station in the area. 3 days later, Glomar left for the Hawaiian Islands, and the surveillance ship headed for home. When Glomar returned to the site on another test run in March 1974, Shteryov convinced his superiors to send out another ship. But this time, the admirals refused to risk one of their best-equipped ships to the storm-racked winter waters of the northern Pacific, and agreed only to send a hydrographic expedition ship that was already out at sea. That ship's commander decided Glomar was on a quest for oil, and he soon left the scene. An old tugboat took over surveillance, but stayed only 10 days. When Glomar finally began the recovery attempt in July, Shteryov again begged for a surveillance ship. By now, however, he had lost his audience. Besides, his boss just didn't believe the Americans had the technology to go after a sunken sub. Smirnov refused to suffer the subject again, deciding he had no extra ships. Shteryov, trying to go over his commander's head, was rebuffed with one line. "I direct your attention to the more qualitative performance of scheduled tasks."